Welcome back, friends, to episode 58 of the Nats GM Show, the only podcast available exclusively via the Nats GM Radio Network. I'm your host, Ryan Sullivan, editor-in-chief of NatsGM.com and the Baron of All Baseball Podcasts.
This is Matt from MattsBats.com, and you're listening to the Nats GM Show.
Now, I am proud to welcome to the show the co-host of the Grant and Danny Show on 106.7 The Fan, well-known comedian, and the man with the best bat speed in the DC media, Danny Ruhier. Danny, welcome to the show.
Thanks, dude. Good intro. It's a dubious honor, by the way, with some of the guys in the media corps. I would still put FD Santangelo ahead of me as he was a big leaguer, but if, you know, close second to that guy, I would certainly take that. My wiffle ball impersonation skills are off point, so maybe that's more appropriate.
Well, I played against you in high school a little bit. Well, to say play, I probably watched you from the bench, but you could quite rake. So I don't know. I think you and FP might be right there today.
I'll take that. I mean, you know, he's a couple years ahead of me in terms of age. So yeah, we'll see. I mean, I love the wraparound of foul ball. So you know, bat speed wasn't the issue. But I don't know, split speed, athleticism, and having a 2 cent head on my shoulders that held me back.
But as I kind of alluded to, I think most people know you from your radio career, you know, in the D.C. area. But you were quite a player at St. Albans, and then you went and played at GW. You were quite a hitter.
Yeah, I appreciate you mentioning that because it's usually awkward when I bring it up because no one asked. But I appreciate it. You know, it's one of those things where each level you jump up, you're always kind of reminded just there's so many great players. You know what I mean? Like, I remember my junior year, going into my senior year over the summertime, I went to this thing called the Best of Virginia Showcase Camp, right? Where they were like, oh, the numbers don't matter. We just give you a number to help track you for the week, right? I was number one. I think I was number 168 for the week, right? And the numbers don't matter. Well, the guy that was number one is a dude named Michael Kadai, who, you know, your fans I'm sure know, who, you know, has raked, you know, 320 in the big leagues and has been a middle of the order bat at different points in his career. And I remember I had my showcase BP in front of all the college coaches, and I had a great round, dude. I don't lie. I had like 6 or 7 bolts out of 12 swings. I was feeling great about myself. Well, Kadir comes up about 10 guys later with a wood bat, and he's just, well, 30, 40 feet past where I'm doing it. And I'm going, oh, I get it. That's a different level. You know what I mean? Like, so you're always kind of humbled and reminded when I got to college, everybody was a shortstop. Everybody was all everything. I had a decent career and was able to get some of my education paid for at the incredibly expensive George Washington University.
Yeah, and you got to play with former National Mike O'Connor, I guess, right? Did you guys overlap?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, okay, I still stay in touch. His career now wound down, but you know, had a few times. And I remember going to a start of his at RFK, where he's pitching for the Nats. He did well, was a reliever, of course, for the Mets and some other spots. Looked like an octopus walking on land with his delivery. You know what I mean? Just so many arms and legs and, you know, more deception maybe than pure stuff. But not a knock on him at all. Was a great teammate and still is a really good dude. It was cool to see his success.
Yeah, that was really amazing to see just the local boy having so much success that season. Just unfortunately, yep. It didn't stick around, I guess.
Right.
So let me transition, if I can, a little bit. I want to talk to you about your comedy career. I guess you got out of college at GW, as you mentioned, and then did you go to New York? Did you try to? I guess you did some comedy in the local area, and then you went up to New York.
Yeah. So I always kind of wanted to do something else, but you know this from playing sports in your high school at Georgetown Prep. I imagine it was kind of like this. You sort of had to pick a lane. You know what I mean? And jocks didn't do the other stuff. Like, I wasn't supposed to be in plays. Those kids didn't like me, and I didn't like them, and they didn't want me as part of their stuff. But I was kind of, you know, I was kind of at that hankering, A, for attention, but B, to kind of, to perform in some way. I kind of didn't have any outlet, didn't really know what to do. And once I was done playing, I was, you know, sort of searching for that next thing that I was passionate about. You know, like, once they told me, hey, you're not good enough to play baseball anymore for money, I said, okay, well, I got to figure something else out. I don't care about being a consultant or having a regular job or anything like that. and just kind of on a whim, I took an improv class, like a weekend warrior at the DC Improv. And I met a couple of stand-up comics who were actually in that class trying to, sort of improve their stage presence, and sort of started hanging out with a couple of these guys, and they helped me write jokes and get on stage and try it for the first time. And as soon as I did, I fell in love with it. I was like, here's my new drug, here's my new fix, here's my new sort of competitive thing. And that was about 12 years ago. And, been doing stand-up, and I'm still passionate about it, of course, ever since. And I moved to New York, as you mentioned, in 2007, and was up there doing it full-time, which meant I was a painter, a mover, a waiter, a temp, kind of whatever I could to pay the rent at night. And then, got really lucky, a series of breaks, and ended up coming back down here to D.C. to do a radio show on a station that I grew up listening to.
Yeah, what was the crappiest job you had to do in New York?
So many to pick from. Being a mover in the summertime, walking up those Brooklyn walk-ups and those spots in Lower Manhattan with no elevators, in 110-degree pea soup heat. And those are awful. Some of those temp gigs that didn't pay squat, but were just terrible, bending over, hurting your back, filing. Those things were not glamorous. It was basically just to do enough to pay the rent, and then you could, try to hustle and get to 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 stand-up shows a week, and to show your face and get known. And that was the whole point. It was trying to grab as many gigs and getting yourself out there in that community as you could. And it's a grind. I mean, it is a really, really tough existence up there when you have a bunch of people that think they're the funniest guy in the world kind of swimming in the same direction. It is certainly a challenge, but you sort of either come through that on the other side with your spirit, or you get broken and go do something else,
Yeah, do you know local comic John Conroy, by the way? He was a guest on the show a while back.
Yeah, I know John. John started a little bit after I did here in D.C., so we didn't run in like the exact same crew, if that makes sense, but saw John like start and then get really, really funny, and moved to Minneapolis. It was a huge part of that scene there, and I was a local at that club, but a guy that really found, this is going to sound so kind of hokey and fruity, but like who found his voice as a comic, and it got really, really funny. So it was cool to see guys that I knew or started with who are doing so well now. There's a bunch of guys. We could certainly run through them.
Yeah, and I was going to say, because the DC comedy scene when you went to New York probably wasn't anywhere near as strong as it is today. Would you have had to, quote-unquote, go to New York if you were trying to be a comic today?
It's different, Ryan, because it's the same kind of strong. There's like classes. It's almost like high school, honestly, where we had a really good class of comics. So I can run through it. One of my best buddies in the world is Rory Scovel, who's now kind of markedly famous, but he had a show on TBS. He's been on Conan a bunch of times. He was on a show right now on True TV. He's doing great. Ryan Connor was on Last Comic Standing. He did really well. He writes for a TV show. Jeff Maurer, who I started with, writes for John Oliver on HBO. Seton Smith is a good buddy of mine. He started here, and he was on the Mulaney Show on Fox, and he's a constant guest on Larry Wilmore's show on Comedy Central. A partner on Charlo's out in L.A. doing really well, and Hampton Yalk is out there as well doing his big thing. So we had kind of this, like, big, really good class. Then we all sort of leave to go get bigger opportunities, whether it's New York, L.A., or kind of otherwise. And then kind of the next that comes along in a local comedy scene. And it's cool. I mean, it's a weird thing to go to New York as being kind of a big fish locally in Washington. Then you go where no one cares about you. No one knows and no one wants to know in a big city like New York. And then you come back down, and it's like, well, I don't know anybody anymore. I'm the outsider. And I help, like, and not to over-inflate my own accomplishments here, but I was one of the guys that really helped sort of grow this scene at one point, and none of these people know who I am. It's kind of a weird feeling to come back to, but it's also it's humbling. It sort of keeps you working, and you always have to kind of prove yourself and see what's next.
So, and I think you alluded to it, but I started listening to you, I think, on The Fan. You were still kind of commuting back and forth to New York, if I remember correctly.
You do remember correctly, man. I was 100%. I started as the nighttime, part-time fill-in co-host with Holden Kushner all the way back in the end of December, really, of 2009. They would tell me, hey, it's Monday, can you come Wednesday? Or, on Friday, can you come on Monday? And you just said yes. You never wanted to say no, because then you know, the last somebody else. So I was taking the bus, the Mega Bus, the Bolt Bus, the, you know, the Greyhound, Chinatown Bus, D.C. to New York, the Bamboos Bus, whatever the hell else, you know, to keep it cheap, going down every week, right, sometimes multiple times a week just to, you know, to be able to crack the mic. And it was, you know, it's a time that I don't miss, per se, but it was you know, kind of my adventure. And, again, it's one of those spots where you just can't say no at any point. You always have to be available.
Yeah, I mean, that was your paying your dues. I mean, I assume kind of in the – so how did 106.7 find you? Was it that you were local, or what? How did they kind of come about and find Danny Ruggie, so to speak?
It's funny. It's obviously the typical path, right? New York comic, you know, who's making stupid YouTube videos about the Redskins gets a radio show. That's formal. No, I knew the program director, Chris Kinert, a little bit from – before moving. I'd actually even done a demo for them before they flipped to sports and was kind of told, hey, you know, we like it okay, but we can't really do another sports show now. Well, another sports show or the network changes to sports, and all of a sudden, you know, I'm emailing them every week, and I'm text messaging, and hey, I'll get any response, of course, because everyone's emailing and texting him and
of
giving him up, you know, and everybody wants to do it. And that's kind of both the beauty and the challenge of the spot is that everybody thinks they can do what you do and has no hesitation in tearing you down and, you know, and making fun of you and kind of whatever else. But, so I was in New York. I was doing these weekly Redskins videos. Just kind of, I'm a disgruntled fan. You know, my wife was holding the camera. And, you know, I got a show briefly on Sirius XM. That went okay, you know, for a little bit, but I had kind of a demo, and once my foot was in the door there, that sort of made me a little bit more appealing back here in D.C. So the perfect confluence of events is right before Thanksgiving in 2009, one of my videos that I did got around 120,000 views, kind of all told on the different platforms and stuff, and Brett, the producer of the Junkies at the time, got a hold of it, played it on the air. The guys, you know, my idols, the Junkies, didn't dump on it. You know, they were kind of like, oh, this is fine. And so my phone's blowing up that morning, and I'm like, dudes, I'm asleep. I'm a comic. Like, leave me alone here, right?
Right.
And, you know, so I get in touch with Brett and said, hey, I'm the guy that did that stupid video. I'm from D.C. I'll be in town. Can I come on the show? And he's like, yeah, come in the day before Thanksgiving at like 9:55. You know what I mean? Like,
right, exactly,
the most
yeah.
important segment of the year where the guys have already kind of checked out. So I did that spot. It went pretty well. I did a bunch of voices for him. I did like Charles Barkley and Shannon Sharp and you know, a couple other dudes. And it was you know, mildly funny, I suppose, but they were nice. And that kind of happened to be the day that you know, they were looking for that nighttime, part-time kind of fill-in guy. And you know, PD asked me, "Hey, do you want to do this?" And I said, "Of course I do. Of course I do." So it, you know, kind of grew from there. I was doing a show a week in between when the Wizards were playing, and then sometimes there's two shows, sometimes three, and, you know, sort of kept going and going. And luckily enough, after a while, they gave me the night show, and, you know, I've been there ever since. So it's been an incredible ride for sure.
When did you move back from D.C., or pardon me, when did you move back from New York to D.C.?
Full time wasn't until 2011.
So really?
It was about 14 months of kind of commuting, kind of staying with my folks, and sort of you know, putting all these things together as best I could. That was such a challenge, but especially because, you know, my poor wife was up there working her real full-time job in New York without any kind of guarantees from me. We weren't going to move back down unless I had something, you know.
Right.
And, it wasn't until 2011 I actually finally did get that something.
Mm. So then, was that when you started with, was it Holden and Danny? Was that 2011?
That was in 2010, doing the night show. Then Holden got promoted to middays.
Right.
And Bill Rowland switched. We were just doing overtime.
That's right.
And then it was 2011 where it was overtime with me. And then in 2011 as well, kind of the end of that year, we did, Holden and Danny in midday, splitting time there in the middle of the day.
How did you get paired up with Holden? Was it just, you know, two local guys and both baseball guys?
Well, the first time it was just kind of, it was that, you know, that part-time fill-in role. We just kind of got thrown together, but we got along really, really well. And, you know, he had a background at the baseball channel, was just a really accomplished guy in covering baseball and worked at Sirius XM on baseball. And I, of course, had my background in the game. So, that kind of was a natural fit for us as we sort of ramped up our kind of role with the Nationals and being the flagship station and everything like that. It was kind of a natural fit to have the two of us do the show.
Yeah, I'm not sure Holden ever gets the credit for as good of a baseball reporter and guy as he is.
Oh, he's great. He is a superstar talent. And it's just, you know, one of those awful things about kind of the radio gig. He's doing so well now, by the way, and deservedly so. He's a great dude. He's so, so knowledgeable about the game. And he and I didn't always agree, but that's fine. You know, it's almost part of it. It's almost better that we didn't just have shut eye on team building and philosophies and all those kinds of things, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So then I think you then get partnered up with Grant, who you've been partnered with. Goodness, it feels like a long time now.
Well, and you know, in radio years, this is like our 30-year anniversary. Yeah, but the beginning of 2012, he and I, excuse me, beginning of 2014, rather, he and I started working together. So we just passed our 2 years. But he and I have been friends, you know, before his ultimate, you know, ascension or promotion into that role. And yeah, we'd kind of gotten along. And again, we don't always agree on stuff. He's kind of the consummate reporter, sort of, you know, sports nerd, so to speak, just an encyclopedia of stats and games and moments and players and the like. And I'm, of course, I'm armed with some of those things too, statistically, but mostly just the obsessed fan that's irrational and can't be trusted.
Yeah, once again, I'm going to use the same compliment, but I don't think Grant gets the props, I guess is the worst way to say it, but the props for being a baseball guy that he is either. His show is tremendous on Sirius every week.
Absolutely, yeah. He does a great job. I mean, he's been doing that for a decade. You know what I mean?
When
he
was a kid,
he had to ride up there to talk about minor leaguers in the system. So he's absolutely a qualified guy for sure. He's great.
I mean, he was doing that before Baseball Prospectus and Baseball America really made that popular. I mean, like you say, a 100%. Decade ago, it's just amazing.
Yep.
So,
yeah, well said.
Yeah, so let me, once again, I'm going to poorly transition, but I'd love to transition now and talk just some Nats with you.
Let's do it.
First, I just, I want to get your thoughts a little bit now that we've, you know, we're 6-8 months away from the end of 2015. Just reflect on your thoughts on the season and, you know, reflecting on what was just a really disappointing year.
Well, what I tell people an awful lot, Ryan, is I love the idea that as a guy that was hoping baseball would come back to Washington my entire life, and back in 2004 and 05 and 06, when it was just me and like 80 guys at RFK, you know, starting no Dallas Perez pitches, I would love to be able to say that an 83-win season is a disappointment. You know what I mean? That's something that like I'll never quite take for granted again. Now, the expectations are raised higher, as they should be, because the organization has been in a position for the last several years to do some special things. Some have happened, some haven't. We know the history, we don't have to go into it. But it was disappointing last year because they were right there. I mean, the blame of injuries, I get that. People get hurt, and it's going to happen, especially when you have a couple off-injured players, as they do. The difference is, though, the Cardinals had injuries. The Mets had some key injuries as well. Their version of Ian Desmond didn't hit 220, and that's why they're winning all these games. You see what I'm saying? Like, at a certain point, players, you know, 2012, they had injuries as well, but Tyler Moore hit 10 bolts, and you know, name that Cora or whoever the heck in the past has played well. Scott Hairston had some big moments, and you can go down the line with Chad Tracy hitting home runs and the like. That was missing in 2013. It was missing as well in 2015. They didn't have guys step up in the absence when Worth isn't 100%, when Zimmerman's out, et cetera. You didn't have those kind of, you know, yeoman's work from guys that probably shouldn't be everyday players just yet. So, yeah, it's disappointing. It's disappointing to get regression years from guys like Jordan Zimmerman a little bit, who had the worst year of his career in a walk season, ERA in the mid-threes, which for everyone else is good, but for him it isn't. It's not what we're used to there. So it was the perfect storm. It was 25 guys, 25 cats. They just were not together last year as a team. And really a lot of that is a reflection of kind of the tension, kind of the tightness of a Matt Williams-run clubhouse.
Yeah, and I don't want to overlook Matt Williams, but I did want to touch on something. I think you make a great point. I don't think Mr. Rizzo and the front office did a good enough job of preparing that team for, hey, Anthony Rendon is going to get hurt. Ryan Zimmerman's going to get hurt. Jason Worth is going to get hurt. Wilson Ramos didn't, but he's probably going to get hurt. And like you say, mm-hmm. The depth of that team was just, it really did not either, it wasn't good or it didn't step up in 2015 at all.
Yeah, I mean, you can only pay so many guys. I mean, Ryan Zimmerman famously said to us, not everybody gets to make $100 million, you know, and he's dead right about that. So you're going to have to cut some corners in certain spots. And a lot of that was, they did it with the bullpen, Ryan. I mean, you saw it. Guys that,
true,
that haven't done it before. Hey, Blake, you know, here's the eighth inning. They want to rethink that. Well, they did after the first month, and things changed. It was, you know, remember Matt Grace was the eighth inning guy for 2 weeks, and then it was, you know, Rafael Martin for a couple weeks, and it's sort of everybody gets a turn. That's when you got to go pay Max Scherzer. Okay, if you did that, well, you got to skimp somewhere else, and that's kind of what happened. So, guys, it shouldn't be everyday players. I love Clint Roberts, great dude. He's hilarious. He's a nice bench bat, and you know, I wish him well. But he should not be getting 400 at bats for you. Period. End of story. Michael Taylor should have been in the minor league all of last year. And again, I think he's going to be a really nice player. But counting on him to play more than he's ready for is you know, is kind of a failing there. And it's not necessarily I blame the Nationals or blame Mike Rizzo for it. It's kind of, you know, you're sort of plugging and playing here. It's like, you know, plugging holes in the dam. You hope some of them hold longer than others, and of course they didn't. So Worth was never right. He was never healthy. Desmond had a career worst year. Ramos, career worst year. It's the perfect storm, kind of as we alluded to, yeah.
And I want to just kind of give you the floor to get your take on Matt Williams, and particularly now that we're a little away from the situation. He's been fired for a few months, so to speak. Just how much blame should he have gotten, and how much, you know, was fair for him to take?
This is such a complicated question, Ryan, and I'm not dodging it. I'm just acknowledging it. He, off the field, is as nice a guy as we encountered. I mean, you know, would go out of his way to be nice to me and to Grant, and sort of remembered us and always had funny anecdotes, and, you know, was a very approachable, personal, you know, kind of nice guy to be around. But that didn't match, A, his on-field persona, sort of the obtuseness, the cluelessness at times that you would see, just, you know, decisions that were just so hard to justify that you wondered what the thought process was. You wondered where his bench coaches were. You wondered where guys were sort of inputting to him and how he got to those decisions. And you sort of find out over the course of the year that he's not leaning on them and just kind of making decisions himself. And then you see the Papelbon-Harper incident. He wasn't aware of it. Sent Papelbon out for the ninth inning and then sort of, you know, didn't understand what had happened even after the game until he'd seen the video, you know, an hour later, whatever the heck it was. That was symptomatic, really, of the entire year. So as a person, really liked him. Again, I didn't interact with him as much as other people did, but as a person, really, really enjoyable to be around. But I think he failed as a manager, whether he was over his head or not, always hard to tell. But I think things just got progressively worse and worse, and they snowballed, and he didn't really know how to handle that, didn't know how to bounce back from that, because he'd never really been through that kind of situation before. He was the answer. If you remember, go back to Davey Johnson at the end. Remember how we all thought, well, that's too loose. Davey's the old grandpa who just wants to give guys Worth's original look quarters behind kids' ears. Well, the answer was Matt Williams in 2014. Look at how this is a military guy. He's a disciplinarian. He's this. Now we're saying, well, we need somebody to be looser. So it's all, you know, the old way is always wrong until the new way is wrong, and then we got to go back and react sort of accordingly to it. But Matt didn't really have adjustments in his game, and that was really evident in 2015.
Yeah, that's a great call. So let's now look ahead, or look, I guess, a little farther into kind of your thoughts on the offseason. Dusty Baker is now the manager. We signed Daniel Murphy, kind of the big signing, if we want to call it that, although we missed out on some other, you know, some other bigger fish, so to speak. Ben Revere is here now. Just kind of your collective thoughts on the offseason.
It's a new club in a lot of different ways. I'll get to Dusty here in a second, but this is a group that I've always argued, a lot of Nats fans get really, really irritated at me, by the way, Ryan. They're probably going to send you hate mail because I'm on the show, but Rizzo's talked about this with us, and I've talked about this forever. The offensive efficiency, whatever the right term is, execution, et cetera. Think about it as a Nats fan. How many leadoff doubles don't score for the Nationals? It seems like that's, you know, twice a game, something like that goes on. That's because it's a high-volume strikeout team. It's a group that's going to sit back and play, you know, Earl Weaver ball, wait for the three-run homer in an era where those don't come as often. You only got a couple guys. You had one guy last year go north of the 20-homer plateau. We know his name. He wears 34 and plays in right field. So you're waiting for all these bolts that aren't coming. If you're the Detroit Tigers, the Toronto Blue Jays, by all means, swing away. But you're not. And they sort of weren't able to adjust and play that kind of, hey, move them up, move them in. Some of those unsexy Kansas City Royals style runs. Well, that's different now. You've got two of the highest contact rate hitters in baseball on your roster right now, probably going to hit in the first half of the order. Maybe Daniel Murphy spots the five, but you get the point. Those are the guys that are going to make more contact. I think that's the big deal for this team. Those runs kind of go unnoticed. They're not as sexy as a three-run bolt, but those are winning runs, especially when you got the kind of pitching staff that they've had and hope to have in terms of some bounce back this year. For Dusty Baker himself, he's as likable a guy as you'll find. I mean, he finds a way to connect to people that has nothing to do with baseball. He gets the most out of guys. Even as pitchers are, you know, having their careers unalterably changed for the worse because they're getting overused, they're going down with the ship. They're like, thank you, Dusty, for everything, you know? So in terms of analytics, in terms of some of his baseball acumen, that's probably the wrong word, but his sort of application of things. He's going to go with his gut and make some decisions that are going to kick off the sabermetricians among us and kick off some of the analysts among us. But overall, he was brought in because he's not Matt Williams. He was brought in quite simply because he deals with people better than anybody that the Nationals organization has had. They need some of that. They need some camaraderie. They need guys to pick up the tab for each other. They need guys to hang out on the road a little bit. They need guys to kind of start pulling for each other. And that's what Dusty Baker does. He sort of energizes people. And that's the biggest thing. You know, it's very rare to have a guy like Buck Showalter or Bruce Bochy who does both, who manages people and also nails baseball strategy, sort of above reproach. Dusty's probably a 10 out of 10 in terms of dealing with people. I would say he's probably a 5 or 6 out of 10 in terms of baseball strategy, in-game type adjustments, and those kinds of things, long-term view. But that 10 out of 10 to me is more important than anything else. So I like the hire. I didn't love the hire. I really didn't like how the process went,
right,
how they low-balled Bud Black and were sort of left with egg on their face because the Lerners do things in a way that baseball sort of doesn't invite them to do, and it's not really normal. But in general, they ended up with a guy that's, I think, pretty good for the right now for this club.
Yeah, and maybe this is something I'd like to ask you as well, because you played at a much higher level, but it's always been my contention that the manager's most important job is from, you know, after the game until the first pitch of the game. I mean, we all point to the mistakes they make during the game, and sure, some are better at managing bullpens and so forth, but the real value of a manager is the time between the game and trying to keep 25 egos together and on the same page.
Yeah, Ryan, I think that's right on, and that's where Dusty excels. But there are two or three double switches a moment per game, especially in the National League, where the manager is important, and what you do is sort of going to get dissected. Do you bunt? Do you not? Do you hit and run? Do you not? Why do you call that pitch out? Those sort of things. Yeah, we can dissect those things, and they're important. But you're right, it's not as important as managing the personalities kind of overall. And we're both DC guys, so we know obviously the name Joe Gibbs. That's what, to me, what made him so special. It's what made Bill Walsh in football so special, is you don't do the same thing to every guy. You don't just have this unalterable approach that you just sort of stick by and yell at somebody the same way. Some people need the carrot, some people need the stick, some people need something in between. Steven Strasburg is not a guy that you want to yell at all the time and get on.
Right.
He's a guy that needs to be encouraged. And that's okay, by the way. It's not a criticism of him. Do you want Steven Strasburg to feel comfortable? Whereas Jordan Zimmerman, you know, it's 20 degrees. He's pitching playbooks. He doesn't care. Like, Jordan, you're like, hey, Jordan, you're pitching tonight. Okay, fine, no problem. But different guys operate differently. And I think that's kind of the importance of what the manager does. It's some guys need a kick in the butt. Some guys need to be told that it's okay and everything in between. So knowing your people, I think it's pivotal. Matt Williams had one way that he did it. Period, end of story. That was a mistake.
What's your take on, I guess, Jonathan Papelbon still being a part of this team and looking like he's going to be the closer in 2016?
Not a fan of it. Not a fan of it at all, Ryan. The main reason why, and we talk about this on our show all the time, is, you know, you can put up with an awful lot you can put up with Manny Ramirez if you're hitting 320 with 40 bolts and driving 150 runs. You can deal with some of those antics. It's cute. It's Manny being Manny. But you can deal with Papelbon being an ornery jerk, but then not really having many friends in the clubhouse. You can deal with that guy's antics of, you know, fan upsetting, sort of just kind of generally again walking around like he's better than the entire institution. You can deal with that if he's nailed. I don't think he's going to be nailed this year. I think a violent, violent, evil, dark, horrible regression in his stats is coming. The velo has dropped, you know, 5, 6, 7 miles an hour. He was 89 to 91 for the most part. The off-speed stuff isn't really there. He was, you know, just blindingly lucky in terms of some of his stats. His fielding and defensive pitching, his contact rates, strikeout rates are all trending in the wrong direction. I am not buying him having a good season, and I think it's going to come off the rails quickly, especially if he struggles early out of the gate still trying to get the arm loose. He blows a couple saves. I mean, think about what Nats fans did to Rafael Soriano. All he did was the job he was brought in to do. It's not even his fault that he replaced the guy that his fans really liked in terms of Drew Storen. Add into that failure in the closing role, which Nats fans don't like, baseball fans don't like. And, oh, by the way, he choked the most valuable player in baseball. So I am not a fan of Papelbon. I really think what happened was they couldn't get any kind of value going in terms of a deal, and the Lerners and Mike Rizzo were just not going to eat that $11 million. And they'll say, well, see what we can get out of him here at this point. Because Papelbon had some no-trade capability, didn't want to go somewhere and not close. That was a big sticking point for him initially to come to Washington. We kind of know, you know, how all that went. So, I'm not a Papelbon guy, and I'm not that excited about his prospects this year. I think that's kind of the black cloud hanging over the team.
Well, let me ask, and maybe this is the maybe you've already answered the question, but looking at this team, kind of what are your thoughts on the team as a whole, kind of optimistic, pessimistic, kind of in that? And what do you think is the biggest, flaw looking at this team, kind of today?
I like this group as kind of a chaser. I do. The Mets are the favorite, although some of the odds makers have them and the Nats right in kind of the same plateau, win total right around 90 wins. I like this group maybe better than last year's because there's a little bit less kind of expectation yoke hanging over their neck. I mean, there's a couple tipping points for them as to how the season will go. It's really the rotation after Max Scherzer, which Steven Strasburg is it? Is it the guy that sprained his ankle and was useless for 7-8 weeks and goes on the disabled list and gets icy hot in his shorts and can't make this start or can't throw off this mound or whatever? Or is he the guy that was just nailed the last 2 months of the season, pitched into a mid-1.5? He was as good as anybody, not being Clayton Kershaw or Jake Arrieta down the stretch last year. What's Gio Gonzalez? Is he the guy that's walking the yard, can only throw 5 innings? Or is he the guy that has some of that 2012 form, letting that sinker work for him a little bit, being in the zone? Is Tanner Roark the guy that, again, lets that sinker work and throw strikes and get ahead of guys and it's right around 3 that can win double-digit games for you? Or is he the guy that was trying to light up the radar gun last year out of the bullpen that sort of got away from who he was? Is Joe Ross a mirage? Does he add that third pitch? Is he effective with that changeup? Is Bronson Arroyo somebody that they count on? So starting pitching, there are a lot of question marks as to how good they'll actually end up being non-Max Scherzer division. Then, of course, you get new names and new faces in the bullpen. Is Sean Kelly really a setup guy? One good year in a pitcher's ballpark doesn't necessarily make a setup man after you put some of those mid-4 ERAs in New York and you kind of get a little squeamish thinking about that guy in key moments. Can Trinan kind of add something to get lefties out? Trevor Gott is still kind of an unknown, although he throws gas. And Rivera, how good is he going to be? So guys in this bullpen, I think, with new roles and a lot of new faces, that remains to be seen. And then, of course, on offense, it's injuries. It's what is Jason worth at this point? He came in with a chip on his shoulder, no pun intended, because of his shoulder problems in the past. But, he seems bound and determined. That and a bus pass will get you on a bus. I don't know how much he had left. Can they keep Ryan Zimmerman healthy? That, to me, is a huge key in that lineup. And really, are they going to be able to score runs without hitting homers? And that's kind of my big thing. By design, they might finally be able to now. You know how much Dusty loves speed, stealing guys and being aggressive on the bases. I think that may come in to play here a little bit. So I actually like some of their makeup, but there's certainly a lot of questions that it could go one of a couple ways or sort of break even down the middle, and they'll be better than the 3 bottom teams in their division, but may not be quite as good as the New York Mets.
Yeah, I think that's actually really well said. I do think that this team is a lot better 16-25 or even 16-30 than they were last year. But agreed. Like you say, there's a lot of questions, 1-15, if you want to call it that way.
Uh-huh. That's kind of where I put it. Yeah, I mean, the guys at the top, you know it. I mean, I just want people to have to be in the zone on Bryce Harper. That means Anthony Rendon has a bounce back here. That means Ryan Zimmerman's health and available. It means Daniel Murphy scoring up the baseball every day. I had a quick conversation with Tom Verducci down in Florida, and he thinks that Daniel Murphy found something and is going to be a 16-20 homer bat, which would just be a coup for the Nationals if they get that at kind of that value. I don't necessarily buy that. I just want that same solid contact and want those same graded bats. But if he's a true middle of the order bat in terms of that many homers at second base, I'll deal with probably 10 or 11 defensive gaffes over the course of the season. So yeah, again, it's Rendon is a key, Murphy's a key, and Zim of course is a key around Bryce Harper.
All right, let's do some predictions here for the season, if we could. What do Bryce Harper's stats look like this season?
I think Bryce goes down a little bit in terms of average, not a criticism, just sort of something that's bound to happen. I think he's a 310 guy, which, by the way, I was dead wrong about him last year. I put him in the 280 range. He, of course, superseded that by 50 points. So this could end up egging my face. I think he's 310, 38 bolts, probably 115 RBIs this year. I think the guys ahead of him will get on a little bit more. I think he probably plays 141, 142 games, one DL stint, kind of notwithstanding. But I think he has an MVP caliber season once again.
What about Anthony Rendon?
I think Rendon is in the 275, 280 range. I think he'll end up with 16 bolts. I think he might end up, if he plays a healthy full season, this is a huge caveat with him, I think he gets to the 100-run plateau again. I think he'll probably end up with 55, 60 RBIs. Not many stolen bases. They're going to try to keep him upright and keep him healthy kind of as much as possible. So if he's hitting in the two-hole, which isn't a guarantee now, he may move down in the order depending on what Dusty wants to do or likes to do. Dusty's not scared to stack lefties. So you may see a different, more run-producing kind of guy, but I'd imagine him in that 280 to 16-bolt range with hopefully those 100 runs scored.
And what are we going to get from Worth?
I think Jason Worth will be replaced. This is my kind of bold prediction. This is my wacky bit I'm doing on the air, Ryan. I think Jason Worth gets replaced by Michael A. Taylor as the everyday left fielder. I think that ultimately happens, whether it's via injury, whether it's via lack of performance. Basically, all the guys that we spoke to, the beat writers down in Florida, were pretty much telling me that Worth has the longest possible leash in the history of mankind just because, you know, Dusty's going to kind of give it to him. I think he makes it untenable. I really think that the guy we saw last year is kind of the new reality for Jason Worth, and he's had a really nice career. Good for him. But this is now kind of paying that tax on that long-term deal that the Nats signed him to. I don't question that deal. I know why they did it. I get it. They kind of needed to change the perception of things in baseball about them, that they weren't there to get participation trophies. They were trying to, you know, become a competitive franchise. He's done a lot of good, some bad. I think you're now talking about a guy that just has to cheat to get back to the same point, and pitchers know that. They're going to expose him. He's got no pop the other way. He used to be able to, you know, if you challenge him with a fastball in the outer half, he was going to punish you to right center. He's now flying open so much because he's so nervous about not being able to get the ball on the inner half that he can't hit that way, period, end of story. So I expect him kind of in that 215, 220 range with only a couple homers and, you know, strikeout numbers, and having to do more to try to do the same is never a good sign for a player. So my bold prediction is that Michael A. Taylor plays more games in left field than Jason Worth.
Well, you took the my last question out of my mouth. That was going to be the bold my bold prediction for you. So there you go.
There you go, right?
How about a win prediction? How about the last one for the Nats?
90 wins on the nose. That's what I've got. I got the Mets at 93. I think the Nats win 90, get themselves a wild card spot. The reason I think that is because this division is so rotten. Minus Miami. I think Miami's going to be frisky for two-thirds of the season until they got to start tinkering with Jose Fernandez's innings. But I like that young core. I like the Yelich, the Ozuna. I like Echeverria. I even like Justin Bour a little bit as a guy that's an ass killer. But that's a group that, you know, one injury to somebody, they're going to fall off. But they're going to be frisky for about two-thirds of the season before they end up kind of in an 80-81 win plateau. But the Phillies are going to be rotten. I think the Braves are going to stink on ice. So teams are going to get stacked, you know, 14, 15 wins against those guys. And that's going to really buoy the Nationals, like it buoyed the Mets last year. I mean, the Mets were under 500 against non-division opponents. Until almost like a couple weeks left in the season. It was uncanny, but they cleaned up in the National League East, including their matchup with the Nationals. So I think ultimately both those teams get fat a little bit off of this bad NL East.
Great point. Great point. Danny, one last I'd like to do a round of rapid fire, if I could, before we get out of here.
Go for it. I'm terrible at rapid fire because I love my voice so much. I overtalk, but let's try it.
All right, let's start. First question. Favorite DC athlete all time?
Art Monk.
Good answer. Least favorite DC athlete all time?
Nick Young.
Oh, okay. I would have guessed Albert Hainsworth. Okay.
Yeah.
Favorite person he's ever interviewed, or you've ever interviewed, pardon me?
That's a great question. Favorite person I've ever interviewed. I could go Riggins. I could go Darryl Green. I could go Ryan Zimmerman. I'm going to go Cal Ripken, my childhood hero.
Okay. Dream interview.
I feel like I'm terrible at this. Okay, dream interview. So that's got to be someone that I haven't interviewed before that's famous. I'll keep it easy and stupid. I'll go Mickey Mantle. Obviously, I can't do that, but that's why it's the rapid-fire question. I'd love to hear both baseball stuff and kind of his life away and just sort of marvel at some of the stories he could spin.
Okay, great answer. Who's your favorite sports junkie?
Favorite sports junkie? I like them all the same. That's totally true. I like them all in different ways. I love those guys. They're my idols, each for different reasons. I really do like them all. Cakes is the nicest guy of all time. JP is sort of like such a radiophile that I always get cool, like, kind of insight and tips from him. Bickle and Jason are both kind of different. They're both hilarious guys. Jason's, like, so hard to please that you find yourself, like, trying to impress him. And Eric and I really don't have anything in common outside of sports. So, you know, I'm always trying to find an in and a good conversation with him. But I'm not just blowing smoke, Ryan. It's a tie for first. I almost said a tie for fourth. It's a tie for first with all four of those guys. I love them all. Sort of individually, but differently.
Okay, very cool. Your favorite sports moment all time?
Oh, Jesus. It's not one moment, so it's cheating, but the 35-point second quarter against the Denver Broncos in the 87 Super Bowl. It was after a kickoff was fumbled by the Redskins, and I'm still convinced to this day that they lost that fumble, but somehow in the pile, the football changed hands. Second quarter gets underway, and then, of course, all the unbelievableness happens. So that 35-point second quarter, where I've never been that euphoric in my entire life, that's my best sports moment of all time.
I tend to agree. I think that's a great one. Favorite Grant Paulson story?
Favorite Grant Paulson story? Again, there's so many to choose from here. I think it was probably the first time that I found out that he doesn't eat cereal with milk. And his justification was that he doesn't like wet bread, which doesn't make any sense because he loves French toast. And he is a pile of hypocrisy wrapped inside of enigma, inside of lies, inside of lack of information. But that was my most stunning one. I didn't have an appropriate reaction. I just kept saying what over and over again. He repeated himself a million times. Then got mad at me because I kept asking him the same question over and over. But that's probably my one seed there.
On a related note, I think I remember the time you discovered he didn't like nachos or something either. Maybe it was for the same reason, and you just went off on him. And I was like, how does a man not like nachos?
I don't know. There's one a week. There's a thing. He doesn't like wings with flavor. He doesn't like, a certain kind of burger. I mean, just each new thing is just a hypocrisy. He doesn't like pie. That doesn't make any sense. Of course you like pie, but he doesn't know that he likes it. Like, he discovered live on air that he liked tacos. He goes, is this what tacos are? And we're like, yes, you idiot. And he's like, I like these. We're like, we know, of course you do.
Yeah, everyone likes tacos. Right, Grant. Yeah.
It's really, really hard to get over some of those things. Chad's convinced, by the way, that Grant the whole time is just, it's an act. That he's just doing it to kind of troll us.
That was my next question. Do you think it's a troll or do you think it's a bit? Because I was kind of wondering if it ever was.
I think it's sincere. This is not like, you know, Christian Bale and his twin brother in The Prestige. It's not like living your whole life that way. You know what I mean? It really is. That's how he is. As mind-boggling as it is, it's real.
It would be a great bit if he was just trolling us the whole time with this food thing, too.
Oh, it's sensational. It would be the greatest, you know, 27-year troll job in the history of organized people. It's amazing.
Oh, gosh. All right, final question for you. Who is the next major D.C. sports team to win a championship?
I think it's the Washington Capitals, and it's no disrespect to the other teams. The Wizards are just not going to break through. You and I were talking off air about that. The Redskins, I think, have a couple ways to go. I don't know if this particular year is the Capitals' year, but there's a window now that's kind of been extended by the presence of Barry Trotz and by Evgeny Kuznetsov. I think that's a group that's got a really, really legitimate shot of doing it. Again, I'm predicting disappointment for this year, probably kind of in a similar round that they've been before, but I like the way this group is assembled and some of the cap figures. They've got me sort of the most optimistic about their chances.
Yeah, I hope DC sports fans realize how good of a hire that Barry Trotz hire was, because he has been unbelievable.
I didn't know it really in advance. And now that I've seen it up close, I get it. I get why that guy is a maestro.
He's amazing. And what he's done basically since the minute he walked in has just been pure magic. Yep. It's been amazing.
It's a different culture for sure.
So, all right, Danny, I could talk sports and baseball with you all day, but I'm going to try to be somewhat thoughtful and try to cut it here for your time and mine. I'd love to give you a spot here for your plugs where people can find you on Twitter, where they can see any comedy shows you've got coming up, just anything you want to plug, where they can listen to your show, you know, anything and everything.
So I appreciate that, man. Yeah, it's at Funny Danny on Twitter and my website and all that kind of stuff is there. You can buy my stand-up CD, which I'm sure, you know, you'll definitely want to after we talk baseball and nerdy sports stuff here after this. But yeah, and then, of course, the Grant and Danny Show every day, 10 to 2 on 106.7 The Van, dude. Yeah, I appreciate you having me, Ryan.
Thank you, and it's all just thank you so much. It's our pleasure and just so thankful that you cleared some time and came on and shared some stories.
That's awesome, dude. Go to an Almond Screw Prep. Thanks so much, Ryan.
Have a great one. Thank you so much, Danny.
I was just kidding about that last part, buddy.
And that was episode 58 of the Nats GM Show with my special guest, 106.7's own Danny Ruelier. Really want to thank him for coming on the show. I've been trying to get him on for a little while, so I really want to thank him for coming on. And that was a lot of fun talking to a fellow D.C. native and sports fan. So thank you so much, Danny. A couple quick things before we get out of here. First and foremost, if I might, the show is looking for a sponsor or sponsors. So if you or anyone you know is interested in sponsoring the Nats GM Show, please go to natsgm.com for further details. Also, if you might do me a quick favor, if you're listening to this on iTunes, please subscribe and please rate and review us as it helps us gather additional listeners to the show. And downloads right to your smartphone or what have you. So it really helps us out. So if you could rate and review and subscribe, that would help us out. Thank you very much. Anyways, we are done for this week. Episode 58 is a wrap. Bye for now.